And we are back with show number 264 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I got here thanks to a magic bean.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm only mostly dead.
And this is Bronson from Australia. And, I've honestly got nothing.
Just someone remind me. Am I wrong about this, but wasn't circumference something from Alias? Anyhow. Someone will get that reference eventually.
I thought he was part of the round table.
Yes. Oh, we are going to be talking about Once Upon a Time, which is probably going to be better than a few of those little jokes that we just told, and also Person of Interest and its winter return, both of these shows coming back after a relatively brief hiatus from the fall. But first, before we do any of that, Edmund, if you could please.
We will be talking about absolutely anything and everything in these episodes, so you must be warned that you will be spoiled, but we have waited a bit of time before we do that, so you should have had time to watch them.
That's right, and we're going to start, as I mentioned before, with Once Upon a Time, and here is the promo.
My, what a nice turnout.
Hope, love, revenge, power. Once Upon a Time wraps it all up in a magical package. Millions can't wait to open every week.
Things are about to change radically.
This January, the series that has America under its spell goes from heroic to epic. As fearsome rivalries clash, family secrets are revealed, and the spell that kept them in Storybrooke is finally broken.
I will not let them defeat me.
What magic are you going to hide behind today?
Oh, not magic.
You will not keep my son from me.
When do we go back?
Where?
The Enchanted Forest.
I wouldn't count on it.
Oh, if the show were only as exciting as that promo. All right, and Gary, why don't you go ahead and give us the recap here?
Sure, absolutely. We're talking about Once Upon a Time, Season 2, Episode 10, The Cricket Game. When Regina is accused of murder, everyone assumes the worst, except for Emma. Meanwhile, in the fairy tale world, Snow and Charming must decide what to do with the evil queen once they have brought her to justice. Gosh, I'm trying to think of where to start. I can't say this was the... best return to the show. I had flaws with both sides. I'll start with the fairy tale side. Usually we start with Storybrooke, but I'm going to start with the fairy tale side this time. It felt like Snow was constantly pulling the chair out from under Regina. Regina, are you sorry? No, I should have killed you. Well, there was your chance, and stick it to her. I'm like, it happened at least twice, and I think maybe a third time if I was paying closer attention, where Snow is basically sort of testing Regina, trying to see if she's changed her ways, why would she in the course of what appeared to me to be a few days? That, first she pretty much heavy-handedly threatens to kill her once, and imprison her once, and then kill her. And both times, right at the very end, before things are about to happen, she comes through and changes everything. And then just as she's going to be led off to death, then she turns around completely and then lets her go after pretty much trying to see if she had turned the first two times, turned back on her evil ways. And then when she still had it, the third time, she goes and lets her go, much to the disdain and objections of almost everyone else. It just seems... so inconsistent even within itself. I had problems with it. And then now you want to switch it back to Storybrooke. We get the sense that while Regina may not be perfect, as we saw at the well, ultimately she still has some redeeming factors to her. And I thought people had, while they don't like her, they at least been coming around to the concept. And obviously it was pretty much just obliterated, in my opinion, because everybody just jumped right on this bandwagon. Once again, we see Rumpel Stiltskin working his scheming in ways that we will see unfurl later. But I mean, I got a sense that he knows that it wasn't Regina with that dream catcher. That even though it showed Regina, I got the sense he knows it wasn't her because of how she's talked and the decisions she's made with him present. That he knows that she is trying to change somewhat and wouldn't do that. So everything just seems to ring so false and inconsistent. I just left me very disappointed with this episode. What'd you think, John?
Well, my first comment is that recap is extremely deceptive because it makes it seem like the Storybrook stuff is going on at the same time as the stuff in the Enchanted Forest. And unlike the fall segment of the season, that's not true. They've now reverted more or less back to the way that they were doing things in the first season, where what's going on in the fairy tale land is a flashback. And yep. What we get, yeah. Like you mentioned, is this really odd situation where when they finally overthrow the queen and her allies and take over the kingdom, you've got Charming and everyone else calling for Regina's death, which felt really extreme for them. And you have Snow, of all people, the one who has been her target all along, basically begging for mercy. And this is how they drop in this little detail about the fact that Rumpelstiltskin and his, basically placed Snow under this protection spell. And the only way that she can ever get back at Snow then is for her to transport Snow into a world where that spell doesn't work. So it becomes another justification for why the queen went through with the curse in the first place, and another example of how Rumpelstiltskin has been playing this very long game in trying to have somebody set off the curse so that he can get to the world without magic so he can find his son. And yet, it still felt, like you said, it rang a bit false. Especially when you then take this as, in the pseudo-lost way of doing things, of trying to show this flashback in relation to the quote, real-time events in Storybrooke, and they're supposed to relate to each other. So we're supposed to learn something about Mercy and Snow's willingness to give the Queen a pass, and then relate that somehow to Emma being willing to give Regina the benefit of the doubt in Storybrooke. But in order to do that, you've got to have everybody in Storybrooke for the third time at least on this show. It's gone on for less than two seasons, and three times now we've had somebody who's accused of a murder, and the entire town turns into a lynch mob, and basically turns on the first person that's pointed at as the perpetrator. Now, granted,
to be quote-unquote fair, most of these characters are the peasants from every Disney movie you've ever seen.
Yes, they are, but I mean, and they act like it. I understand that this is probably the first time that they're actually dealing with somebody who has wronged them so much in the past that maybe they have reason to believe that she would be capable of murder, but this is also the character that has been trying very hard to show that she's turning a new leaf. I doubt that Emma's going to be the one, the only one, that's going to give her a pass, or at least the benefit of the doubt. Because there's effectively no evidence of anything. I would hate to be accused of a crime in this town. Forget a fair trial. You are guilty immediately.
Have we ever seen a judge?
No.
We've never seen anything other than a sheriff. Is this,
and this DA who's actually King George, and we're not quite sure
time he led the mob.
He's the one that incited it.
Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, it all felt just a little overdone. I see what they were trying to do, but Gary, I agree with you. It was some good ideas that didn't quite gel. And I think I was most disappointed with the fact that one of the better things that they've been doing this season is presenting the idea that as bad as Regina and to a different extent Rumpelstiltskin might be, there's someone worse. And for both of them, it's really Cora. And they've done this nice job of showing that, you know, you can take somebody who is evil and has even embraced evil to such an extent that Regina has, and yet make them sympathetic and make it feel like they might have some redeeming qualities. And in fact, from the beginning, Henry, in one form or another, has always been that symbol of what Regina could return to. We've seen her as somebody better. We know she has that potential. So to build that up over 10 episodes or so, and then in one fell swoop, completely turn it around again, it just feels like, okay, what was the point of all that? Never mind the fact that the only way that this makes any sense, is if Cora and Hook therefore stay completely out of sight. Because, I mean, the whole thing is a frame job. It only works if the real person never actually shows up. Okay? Does anyone expect that they're not going to know that Korra and Hook are in town very long? So mm-hmm. at what point do they then start to think, gee, could this have been a frame job? You know, but I'm sure that it's going to persist just long enough for Regina to be on the wrong side again and all this. And you can kind of see where this is all going to go. But yeah. It was just frustrating because it's like you built all this up and then you just kind of throw it away. And it kind of doesn't give the audience very much to work with, you know? And so I felt like it was a lot of good ideas that were just executed poorly. And Edmund, I know that you're just you're chomping at the bit to get some shots in on this one.
Yeah, in terms of the whole interplay, in a way, it's if it was actually doing something meaningful, I would have been happy for them to go back to Storybrooke and then flashback and fill in gaps, because this was kind of filling in the last gaps of how the curse happened, but it just seemed like almost schizophrenic in terms of. Okay, so in Storybrooke, you have this whole storyline where she's trying to redeem herself and show that, she can, be a decent person. We'd seen the flashbacks of, her before, she kind of got corrupted by Korra and Rumpelstiltskin. And then it seemed like the entire flashback was more about, reinforcing that, no, she's an evil person and she cannot change. And, this is just who she is meant to be. And that part made no sense to me. And For me, what really got to me was the whole frame job just felt incredibly clumsy. I mean, the moment I saw her walking into Dr. Hopper's office late at night, I was thinking, that's not her. And then, given what happened, it was like, okay, it's really not her. And then it was like, thinking, well, maybe they'll string the suspense out a little bit. And then they have Korra transform back into herself before they even cut to commercial. So, as the audience, we're sitting there, we know exactly what's happened. And then we get to watch the characters basically run around looking like idiots because they, because they have, are just completely falling for this hook, line, and sinker, except for Emma for a little bit until, this, dream catcher that turns into the romper room magic mirror, after she, manages to actually come up with some magic, confirms, that, oh, it must be Regina. And I mean, I was just sort of sitting there aghast throughout most of the episode of, it was bad enough having that whole just, tack on to the previous episode of, after we've gone through that entire opening part of the season, trying to keep them out. And then they just magically got to Storybrooke, and then they get there and you think, oh, it's the big confrontation. And instead it's just, we're just going to, Korra's just going to hide the boat and mess around with her daughter for a while. and even especially given that preview they've been showing of sort of show, where it was like, oh yes, we're coming down to the big battle. And then it's like, no, we're just going to mess around a bit and, have people get falsely accused again. There was sort of I did have a bit of a hope that they might be, coming back and maybe correcting a few things, and instead it's just more of the same frustrating stuff going on.
What occurs to me, and this is a completely different aspect of the show, but I think that it really strikes to the heart of some of our complaints and the inconsistencies. A lot of shows make an effort to at least look the same throughout an episode in terms of production value. This show varies wildly in visual consistency. There are scenes in Storybrooke that look like it just stepped off of a soap opera set. The one with Korra and Hook on the dock next to the boat looked terrible. It looked like a reality show. Then you go to the stuff that's going on in the Enchanted Forest and you have obvious green screen going on. Stuff that makes some of the really bad season one Covert Affairs stuff look brilliant in comparison. But then a few scenes later, it looks about as good as you would hope that it would look. I don't know if it's the various units on direction that just aren't as solid or what's going on, but the show just looks sloppy at times. In this episode in particular, there were at least three or four different scenes where it felt like they were using like third or fourth level footage because everything else on the good cameras didn't come through right. And it's jarring. And it's the kind of thing that you probably wouldn't notice if it wasn't for the fact that there were all these flaws in the story writing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, as far as the cast goes, I know that we like that the actress who plays Cora, and I'm sorry, her name escapes me. Edmund, maybe you can help me with this one.
Barbara Hershey.
Thank you. That's what I was thinking of. I had the Barbara, but the Hershey didn't get into my head. I mean, she's got a great career, right? I mean, she's known for a number of roles.
Absolutely.
Her portrayal of Cora is at times fine, and other times it is so over the top that it just feels like, how can she be in any scene without everybody thinking that she's the worst person ever? But at any rate, it's all kind of sloppy, and I think that, as I said, if it wasn't for the fact that the story is telling you that there's something not quite right about everything, all these other things might be overlooked to one extent or another. But it just feels like it's still not coming together, and it's amazing that we've had this same problem. The beginning of the season seemed like they were right back on track, and now they're still falling into the same pattern. Ronstam, how about you? I mean, you didn't really have the chance to weigh in yet.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's much more I can add. I just found it... I pretty much found the whole thing lacking due to a lot of the dumb choices on what it seemed was the collective population of Storybrooke and the Enchanted Forest. It's that kind of basic lapse in logic that you usually see from Bond villains, and that's the reason why James Bond always wins, because the villain does something stupid when they could have just shot him. And yeah, that happens. Yeah, well, that stuff like that happens a few times. And even the few plot developments, the things like Snow White, Emma using her magic, it couldn't make up for what I felt like the whole thing hinged on big, dumb assumptions and decisions on the part of so many characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree with you. It was disappointing because I really was hoping that they would come back strong. And unfortunately, they didn't. I gave this one a 6 out of 10. Again, I thought that there were some elements that were good, but it just didn't gel. Mm-hmm. How about you, Gary? What are your thoughts on this?
I'm gonna drop a little bit lower. I'm gonna give it right sort of in the middle at a 5. Some of the concepts were good, and maybe if they had had this episode early in the first season, I could have seen it logically fitting a little bit better. But this would have been good when we were still sort of fleshing out who Regina is and what her motives were. And we're so much past that point, at least I feel we are, that this whole episode just does not fit anymore. It was a first season episode that I felt like they carried over, and it was okay, but it was in the wrong place in the storyline. So yeah, I'm going to give it a 5 mainly for that.
Mm. Okay. Edmund, how about you?
I still go with a 6. I felt it was below average, but I'm kind of with you. Where there was the potential there, just not executed properly.
Mm-hmm. And Bronstone?
I'm gonna go with Gary. I'd go 5.
Okay. And the funny thing is, I mean, those scores were identical to what we gave to the fall finale, Queen of Hearts. So they essentially came back exactly where they left off, with episodes that hit the bottom, the lowest scores for the second season so far. So this show is still struggling, which is really sad to see, because as we've seen so many times, it has the potential to be much better than this. All right, and so we are going to go ahead and move on to Person of Interest, and here is the promo.
While Mr. Reese sits in prison, Mr. Finch is going back to school.
I'm your substitute teacher.
Be careful in there, pal.
Beginning to feel like I'm on another planet.
Can he save a student hacker?
I don't need your help.
From himself.
And why would you want to hide the fact that you're a genius?
Why, indeed.
Okay, so we have the new state of play, I guess you could say, coming out of the fall finale.
Yes.
Yes. And, I guess that it's one of those situations where we had a little bit of an expectation that when they came back, they were going to immediately deal with the fallout from that. But maybe not. And let's go ahead and do this right. Edmund, why don't you go ahead and do the recap for us?
Sure. This is Person of Interest, Season 2, Episode 11, 2πr. The team's newest person of interest is a teen genius, and Finch goes undercover as a substitute teacher to protect him. Meanwhile, Carter takes on her first assignment as a temp agent for the FBI. I think that's an official term, temp agent.
But, oh, sure. All right. Well, yes. Go ahead. Start us off.
No, certainly this was an interesting episode in terms of, you know, yeah, we were certainly all expecting that, you know, that this was the episode that was going to focus on getting Mr. Reese out of jail and away from Agent Donnelly. And instead, they took this little turn of showing us what the team could do if Mr. Reese was not around. Worked, you know, surprisingly well. Although, I mean, my own personal speculation is, as they've been sort of building up the machine as a character, you know, I do not think that it is a coincidence that the person of interest just happened to be somebody who was so up Finch's alley that, it was this genius hacker who, was in a high school where Finch could, you know, so easily slip in as a substitute teacher and obviously feel a great bit of sympathy and empathy with in terms of how to approach him. Certainly in terms of, given what they've been building up to, I mean, it was kind of interesting having this be, you know, a episode where it really did focus primarily on the case, and on the sort of procedural elements of tracking down his details and the whole thing of eventually tracking down that, you know, yeah, the drug dealers he was having problems with were, you know, actually in the end paying him and all the mysteries about the incident with the subway train and eventually discovering that no, it wasn't he had a beef with the drug dealers. It was him and his brother, you know, playing teenage games and his brother being the one who got clipped by the train, and he was dealing with survivor's guilt and dealing with his alcoholic mother and having to juggle all these things at once. And in one sense, I felt, you know, it did show it's like, you know, no, you know, this is a, you know, a really strong team and certainly a strong cast and could operate on their own. But at the same time, I kind of, you know, in the end, I kind of felt, you know, because I had this whole thing of, you know, no, you know, this was the machine kind of tailoring it to them. It's like, you know, no, they couldn't keep this up forever. So, you know, yes, you know, Reese does have his place, and they will need to get him back eventually. But this showed there was at least the possibility of operating without him. But then, I mean, you know, they weren't completely ignoring Reese, of course. And this is probably the part that I found a little jarring was Carter sort of going whole hog into sort of taking every step that was necessary to try and secure Reese's release. And, and sort of on a couple of levels, I mean, you know, we're not that far away from where she was, you know, still having some problems with their methods and things, and her just sort of saying, I've crossed the line enough with you guys and I'm ready to do this. Just didn't quite ring true to me.
Mm.
You know, and certainly not to the point of, you know, no, I could see her stepping over certain lines, but actually going to the point of breaking into law enforcement labs, swapping DNA samples, and then, I mean, much as I appreciated Taraji, you know, in that slinky dress, it was, actually going, you know, to the extent of picking up guys in bars to get their DNA swabs, you know, when not so long ago she was kind of hesitant about, having a dinner date with an attractive colleague. It just seemed to me like, you know, that they were pushing things a little too far too fast with her character. So if anything, that was probably my biggest issue with the episode, but overall, I mean, it was still, you know, it was a, you know, it was an interesting take on, you know, what they could do without Reese around. And, if anything, the other thing that I was slightly, you know, disappointed in was for an episode that was so Finch centric that they, you know, we didn't have more flashbacks and more stuff sort of directly tying in, you know, so, you know, some of his empathy with the hacker, other than, the ARPANET connection, which, I mean, the moment it was first brought up in the computer class, I was like, you know, okay, you know, there's going to be the very strong hint at the end, you know, at the end or somewhere that, you know, yes, that was in fact Finch, but, you know, so, you know, a couple of reservations, but overall still a very strong, if slightly offbeat Person of Interest episode.
I'm not as convinced that we needed Finch flashbacks. I mean, and usually in this show we get to find out the backstory, especially about Finch, is we get the flashbacks, because it would just be really out of character for him to come out and tell a lot about himself. I thought what we got in this episode was an excellent way of not doing either of those, by rather than Finch say, when I was young, I was like this and but withdrawn, you know, a bit rebellious, a bit of that. And just from the performance and from the writing, it becomes very clear very quickly that a lot of Finch's empathy comes from the fact that, like, yeah, this is exactly what I was like. I came out of this episode feeling like I understood so much more about Finch. Not necessarily the details, but just where he came from and what things were like from him, and stuff like that. And I agree, the ARPANET thing was a really cool touch. I called it as soon as they mentioned it, but the way they kind of handled it at the end was just great. As the episode of the whole, there's this someone a few years ago, an online TV reviewer who I really like was reviewing Terriers. When it was coming out. And I might have mentioned something like this before, but to talk about an episode of Terriers, they then referenced the Buffy episode Hush, because this writer thought that both episodes were a good example of how a show can highlight a lot of its unappreciated strengths by depriving itself of an obvious one. Because, of course, in the episode in Hush, in Buffy, none of the characters talked. And the thing that, you know, any Joss Whedon thing gets credit for is the brilliant dialogue. So no one talked for an episode, and it was still awesome. I feel like Person of Interest did something similar in this episode by not having one of the best things about the show, the Reese Finch dynamic. It didn't show up at all. And instead, other elements of the show, you know, got more focus. The other characters and you know, Finch in particular, and how much he's evolved since the beginning of the show, because he's so much more comfortable with doing all the field work. And how much the relationship with Fusco and Carter has developed, how much Carter has developed in terms of, like, you know, she's willing to go all in with Team Machine. Even though I think the degree to which she decided to do that was perhaps a little stronger than warranted. But those two aspects of the thing, finding out more about Finch and, you know, a different emphasis for the episode, I thought they worked together really, really well to create something that I was surprised how much I loved it by the end. Because by the time we're getting into the second act, I was really, really nervous because it was becoming clear. I was like, oh, there's going to be no Reese, and they're barely going to address the cliffhanger. And I was very nervous, and I was very, very impressed with how the whole thing turned out. And then they come back to the cliffhanger in the last few minutes in a really, really good way, and set up an interesting dynamic where it very much looks like they're going to flip the dynamic for the next episode. Not a lot of Finch, a whole lot of Reese.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so...
I agree with you, Bronze Thumb, about the flashback issue. I can understand that it was against the format somewhat, but at the same time, I feel like it was enough exposition to give you exactly the right information that you needed to hear, while not beating you over the head with what the context was, because, you know, they've shown us enough of Finch's background and the development of the machine that you know that he had to be somebody special in order to be able to develop all this stuff. What this episode tells us is essentially, when we see that the government is going and targeting all the people, those few handful of people that maybe didn't just know about the machine, but were involved in its creation, you know, who was the one person that was involved with it the most? It was Finch. And who would be the perfect type of person for them to tap for that type of job? Somebody that was already well established as somebody that could break into all of these existing systems, get them to all communicate together, and then somebody who would be well justified to get rid of after the fact. So somebody who's extremely inconvenient once he got the job done. So to me, it all made sense. It kind of fit into that larger context really, really well. And then, you know, at the end of the day, you didn't really need to see more than that because we've already seen all the rest of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm. So I liked it. It was good because it got Finch out of the that library a little bit more. Because
it got him a bit further out of his comfort zone, and that's something, you know, very important for pretty much any good storytelling, is that you don't, you know, when you let the characters kind of wallow in something that's not challenging them, you don't have a good story.
Mm-hmm.
Forcing Finch to really be the point man. And not in the way, and we've seen previous episodes that have put him in that role, but this is a bit further beyond that. He doesn't even have Reese as the safety net this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, beyond that, one thing I think was exceptional about this, and for me at least took it from at least one step up, was one of his best moments in this entire series, and that was his lesson on pi.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I have no idea if that was adapted from something else. I have a feeling that it may have been. But let me just tell you, as much as it was overplayed slightly by having all of these students just suddenly riveted by what he was saying, I think that it was a good stand-in for what the audience had to be feeling.
If Michael Emerson showed up in my classroom and started telling me about, you know, a number that contained all the information in the universe, you bet I'd be listening.
Yeah. But, you know, they made a little bit of the typical substitute teacher comes in and is dealing with the ruffians and so forth, you know, the dangerous minds and so forth. There's a little bit of a cliche there.
I'd have said Sister Act 2, but okay.
Yeah, well, I try to avoid that as much as possible, but there we go. It did play to that cliche somewhat, so I felt like it was just a little too convenient, but at the same time, it was just to get the point across. But that speech could have been in anywhere, and I think I would have appreciated it because it was the kind of thing that certainly we can appreciate on some level, because being geeks and techies, we really kind of like that kind of profound viewpoint and perspective on things. But I can just imagine how that played for the general audience, because that's something that they never would have even considered or thought about. And mm-hmm. I'm sure that that was like one of those jaw-dropping type of moments for the main audience of the show. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I appreciated it so much, because we talk a lot about the fact that our shows, that the ones that we enjoy, are so outside of the norm. Mm-hmm. And maybe among the people that we know, they're fairly well established, you know, something like Arrow or Supernatural. I mean, They're even a little esoteric, especially Supernatural. When you get to people who like genre shows, they tend to forget that it exists after 8 seasons. But then you've got a show like this that has hit critical acclaim across the main audience, the general masses, the ones that don't usually watch science fiction. And then you use that as a vehicle to introduce something like this. And I just look at it and say, you know, this perfectly encapsulates everything that we say about this show. And about why it succeeds so well as this gateway show for science fiction. And, you know, again, we point to the fact that this is very much a show in the vein of a Lost, where it's stealthily taking sci-fi concepts and building them off of the familiar context of a character drama, or in this case, a procedural.
Yep.
So I really... Go ahead.
Yeah, and you've got all these kind of structural elements, and then on top of that, just solid writing and fantastic performances. I mean, I suspect I will very frequently point back to this episode and just the scene on the train platform at the very, you know, at the end of the episode, of just some of Michael Emerson's most brilliant acting work on the show to date. It's just fantastic.
And you take something like this cliched, you know, teacher drama type of thing, and it's used as a vehicle to show, once again, to remind the rest of the world that geeks have in fact taken over everything, that you can't ignore us, because everything that happens around you in the world is the product of what we do. We're in a technologically advanced society, and stuff like the machine is bound to happen if it doesn't exist already. And it's going to be people like that were marginalized at one point, and maybe felt like they had to hold back in order to survive in high school. Like, what was the character's name in this one? Remind me again. The
Caleb.
Caleb, thank you.
Caleb.
But, you know, he's clearly brilliant, but he's holding back because he doesn't want to make a target of himself.
Right.
And yet, you know, society is going to be dependent upon the things that he's going to create. So it's an interesting, sly commentary a bit on this kind of this turnover in society. I mean, you just look at what the mass entertainment is these days, and it's pretty clear who took over Hollywood. So,
yeah. I mean, there was one other element in there that I wanted to get your guys' take on, because I mean, this whole thing of that Caleb, I mean, had come up with this fabulous compression program. That whole storyline of the computer lab teacher had, appears to have stolen it, and then when Finch challenges him on it, it turns out, I was just making this deal, and Caleb was going to, was going to be the beneficiary of it. That to me seemed a little soft peddling for this, at least for this show. My sense was, in the first season, no, he would have been trying to steal it, and part of the resolution would have been turning that around. And I mean, I just wanted to get your guys' take on it. If you thought the same thing, or if that was pulling punches, or if that rang at all true to you.
I was somewhat surprised that it turned out as positive as it did, but I'm not necessarily sure that the writers have gone soft or anything like that. I think it was just, the more I think on it, the more I want to talk about it. But just the idea that this episode was among the way that it handled the dynamics of the characters and the subject matter and stuff like that, it was also about looking at, as so many episodes of Person of Interest do, looking at the premise from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. Usually it's who is the victim, who is the perpetrator, and we've had a lot of interesting variations on that. But there's always this external thing to it. And this character was just one of, the teacher was just one of several who are red herrings to kind of obscure the fact that when it comes down to it, this is a case in which the victim is their own perpetrator. It's about someone who is a danger to themselves, and mm-hmm. about how do the characters deal with that? And then it comes back to why this is such a good story for a Finch, a Finch-centric episode, because I don't think Reese could have resolved the situation. Or at least not resolved it the way that Finch did.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Because Reese is a very physical person, and when Reese does tend to talk his way out of a situation, 9 times out of 10, it goes along the lines of, you're about to do something bad. Trust me, you don't want to do this. Take it from the guy who's done something bad and has to live with the consequences. There was a little bit of that to that, but Finch is coming at it from a whole different perspective, and he has a whole different approach to these kinds of things. And it's just all of these different elements of the episode of the performance, the writing, the structure, the story, how it toys with the premise, which is tying together so well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't have a problem with it either. I mean, it. Yeah, that kind of reduces everything down very quickly.
Yeah. I saw they got off track a bit, but
it's okay. I mean, just to address Edmund's thing, but I didn't have a problem with it because it felt like they were playing on, and I mentioned this before, the cliche of the teacher drama anyway. And I think that Bronstein was correct that it was more of a red herring than anything else. And then once they pulled the real trigger, they had to just dispense with that red herring as much as possible. And I think maybe it was good for them to even address it at all. Because in a lot of stories, they would have, once they revealed that it was a red herring, they never would have gone back. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if it's a weakness, it's more, at least in my mind, on the positive side. At least they did something.
I wasn't saying necessarily as a weakness. I mean, it was just the context of the show, and even in a way, in the context of real world. I mean, it was, I was thinking, that didn't necessarily make sense to me. And, and certainly, we have seen, I mean, whether it's, Finch sitting down with the CEO and telling him how he just shorted his company and took him out. It's like, no, that's something Finch certainly could have dealt with, if it was going the other way. So, But
yeah, I mean, I acknowledge
but,
that.
But I think you're right. Yeah, but I think you're right in terms of the course of this discussion. It's you know, I've realized there was other stuff going on in this episode that you know, that it made more sense that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see. I wound up giving this one at least an 8. I was between a 7 and an 8, and I wound up giving it that 8 because of that pie speech, as I mentioned before. Edmund, how about you?
I mean, I was between a 7 and an 8. I actually dropped down to a 7, but I think it was really more the Carter stuff that got to me and dropped it a bit. But yeah, I wound up at a 7.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Bronson?
I'm teetering between an 8 and a 9. Honestly, I'll probably go an 8 because we, you know, I did miss Reese during the episode, and it was a bit shaky in the beginning. But 8 definitely seems fair because it did just. I still think it just tied together everything that makes this almost everything that makes this show fantastic, despite having deliberately deprived itself of one of its greatest strengths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, definitely, it's the show continuing to do very well, and nice return. A little bit offbeat. We didn't really see it going this direction, but I think it was a little bit of a breather in that respect. And, yeah, looking forward to seeing how they then take it to the next level with the next episode, because obviously that ending scene makes it very clear that they're going to be focusing on Reese in the next episode.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
All right, well, as we wrap up, we only had those two... Oh, go ahead, sorry.
And I was going to say just the one thing that bugged me at the end when I started thinking about it is, who was looking after Bear?
Mm-hmm. Bear looks after Bear. All right, yeah, just another one of those little mysteries.
Yeah.
All right, we have a little bit of time because we only had two episodes to dissect in this particular show, but I did want to just kind of hit on a couple of the shows that we have reviews for over on the website, but we really usually don't talk about these things, but just a couple quick comments maybe on these particular shows. Let's see, American Horror Story came back from its little hiatus during the winter break, season 2, episode 10, The Name Game, and our reviewer gave that one a 7 out of 10, which is fairly consistent with the four episodes that came before it, and I would have to agree that a 7 is right about where I would put it. It's kind of fallen into that very average category. Either of you guys watching that show at this point? I don't think you are, but...
No.
I didn't think
I'm not.
Yeah. So I'd be interested to hear if anyone in the audience felt any better or worse about the state of the show at this point. It's unfortunately, it's one of those that started off very strong and then just kind of hit a bit of a rough patch here. We mentioned in our previous show Elementary coming back in season 1, episode 11, Dirty Laundry. And Bronstum, you gave that one a 7 out of 10?
Yep, it was up to that point it had been very in keeping with the show, with how that show does. Like it's fairly well made, it's got a good cast, but the procedural mysteries tended to be weak. And I still have trouble reconciling Johnny Lee Miller and Lucy Liu's characters with Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. But it was not a... I don't know. It was not a chore to watch.
Mm-hmm. So you gave that one a 7 out of 10. And Edmund, do you watch that show?
No, I do not.
Okay. Yeah, I think it was Gary that said that he was watching it, so... yeah, again, if anyone has a divergent opinion, you can leave comments over at the website or give us your comments and we can talk about them here. Now, Bronstam, I know that you definitely watched this show. Merlin came back, as we mentioned, season 5, episode 1, Arthur's Bane, part 1. And Greg gave this one an 8 out of 10. And let's see, what did you think of that one? I know it was the first part of a two-parter that was at the beginning of the season. It might have been a little while since you've seen it.
A little while ago. Yeah. No, 8 out of 10 sounds about right. It was a strong return. It shored up sort of the any questions about what might have become of the dynamics in the time between seasons 4 and 5, because season 4 ended with a big crowning moment.
Mm-hmm.
And season 5, you know, it got into showing us how things are different and how they're the same. And starting up the new... getting started on the new plot arc of the season,
right?
Which was a very interesting and very character centric arc that winds up going quite well.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by the time gap that they had between season 4 and 5, but I suppose that it made sense considering how quickly they accelerated things at the end of the fourth season as a whole. So there we go. And finally, another one of these little quick hits that we have here. We have The Good Wife came back. Season 4, Episode 11, Boom Da Yada. Is that how that... whatever. Henry gave that run a 6 out of 10. And generally speaking, he's been less enthusiastic about this season than he has about past seasons. And I know that there are a lot of people that are very passionate about that show out there. And I'd be interested, once again, to know if you agree with that or not. You can go on over to the website and get the full reviews. And also go ahead and give us your full opinions. But that's about it for this show. Any last thoughts on the episodes that we were talking about today?
Nothing comes to mind.
All right, then.
Looking forward to see what they do next in at least one case.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, a person of interest is just begging for people to be waiting with bated breath. And can I just say that I am looking forward in a big way to the last 3 episodes of Fringe.
Mm.
Yeah, I think
it will be missed, but while we've still got it, it shall be enjoyed.
Oh, yes. I think that everybody can be anticipating that we will be kicking off our next show with our Fringe comments.
Yes.
Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there is also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time.
Hi. Can any of you tell me what it means? I'll settle for an intelligent question here. Yes.
My friend has a question, Mr. Swift. What is any of this good for, and when would we ever use it?
Let me show you. Pi, the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter, and this is just the beginning. It keeps on going. Forever, without ever repeating, which means that contained within this string of decimals is every single other number. Your birth date, combination to your locker, your social security number, it's all in there somewhere. And if you convert these decimals into letters, you would have every word that ever existed in every possible combination. The first syllable you spoke as a baby, the name of your latest crush, your entire life story from beginning to end, everything we ever say or do, all of the world's infinite possibilities rest within this one simple circle. Now, what you do with that information, what it's good for, well, that would be up to you.